This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
When JoJo Moyes wrote Me Before You in 2012, she wasn't expecting to write a follow-up. But the unlikely heroine of that book, Louisa Clark, just wouldn't leave her. So Moyes penned After You, which was published in 2015. But Louisa Clark kept speaking to her, so Moyes wrote Still Me, which arrived at bookstores this week. JoJo Moyes is on tour this week, but I caught up with her via phone to talk about the unplanned series, her research, and what she's working on next. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. Still Me is the third book in a series about Louisa Clark. And readers were first introduced to her in Me Before You, when she took a job as an unlikely caregiver for a quadriplegic man who was contemplating ending his life because he was not happy in his life. And then you wrote After You, which continued Louisa's story. And now this third book is Still Me. So were you expecting to write more after Me Before You, or you know, does Louisa still speak to you?
Yes. I mean, the reason I ended up writing a sequel, because, I mean, I've got to be honest, when I wrote Me Before You, I was barely expecting that to get published, let alone any follow-ups, because when I wrote it, my publishing career at the time was, let's say, a little checkered. I certainly wasn't achieving the kind of sales that people wanted me to. And so I was quite anxious about whether I even had a publishing career. So I wrote this book not knowing how it was going to be received or how many people would ever read it. And then, as you know, the response to it was kind of phenomenal. And it just snowballed. And then it kept going and kept going. And 4 years later, I was working on the film and writing the script. And I had this sort of deluge of emails from people who wanted to talk to me about Will and Louisa. And I ended up finding that I was asking myself the question that lots of people were asking me, which was, what happened to her afterwards? Because what I found was that most people, you write a book and your characters just slip away from you because you go on to your next book or you're busy or whatever. You know, you grieve them for a little while and then they're gone. That never happened with Louisa because of the emails and because of the work on the film. She was ever present in my head. And so I started to ask myself, well, how would you respond to having been part of the events in that book? How would you respond to not just seeing the person you loved most in all the world end their lives, but having to accept that you may have been party to that decision? And although Me Before You ends on a kind of fairly hopeful note, what I felt fundamentally was that Louisa would not bounce back, that, you know, she would actually struggle with very conflicting feelings about how she'd been part of that for quite a long time. And so After You was really an attempt to explore the life behind the headlines, if you like. What happens after the news has gone away? What happens after the big event has happened? And how do you elevate yourself out of grief? Because that seems to be a situation that many people I know have found themselves in. And so that was really the thinking behind two. But as soon as I knew I was writing two books, I knew I wanted to bring her back up again. I saw it as like a horseshoe shape, and Still Me is really the right-hand side of that horseshoe, bringing Louisa up, having her kind of punching skyward again, if you like.
So you said you wrote the screenplay for the movie For Me Before You?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that. And I'd seen the movie. I remember when you came for Me Before You and you were talking about it. And I don't know if, you know, I think you had been hearing from everyone, you know, our audience included, how it would make such a great film. And you were talking about, I think it was Intouchables, and how that movie had already come out. And was that the same Weinstein who is in the news now?
Yeah,
okay.
Well, you have a good memory. Because what happened was, as soon as Me Before You came out in the UK, it generated a lot of interest from European movie companies. And we sold the movie rights. Or we agreed to sell the movie rights, I should say. And I had a couple of meetings with the company involved, and I was really excited because I've sold movie rights before, and it's really just like a lottery ticket. You know, it's the odds against anything actually happening are pretty huge. But this time I felt like there was this weird energy behind it that, you know, that somehow this was actually going to make it. And so we had this meeting, and then I sat back and let the lawyers do their thing, and then I didn't hear anything, and then I didn't hear anything, and then one day I got a phone call, and it was the lawyer on my side, and he just said, I got to tell you, I'm afraid they've pulled out. And I said, why? They were so keen. And he said, well, Mr. Weinstein has put out a statement, possibly because he's heard that you guys are doing your movie, and he's bought the rights to do an English language remake of a film called The Untouchables, which is about a French man who is left quadriplegic after an accident and who develops a kind of bond with his African, his French African carer. And I was really disappointed because I'd really felt that there was this kind of tremendous energy behind it, and I really thought that this something was going to happen this time. And so I kind of went home and kicked a few walls and felt a bit grumpy for a bit. And then I thought, no, I need to just get over myself. And then the book, Me Before You, came out a year later in the US. And in that first week, I had this extraordinary review in the New York Times. It was a kind of life-changing review, A, because it took commercial fiction seriously, but B, because it was just, it was an incredible review. It just said everything about the book that I would want somebody to say. And on the back of that review, we just had a deluge of interest from Hollywood. And so when I saw you, I think it was the early part of a tour, which would later see me fly to L.A., and agreed terms with MGM, who eventually went on to make it. That's my Weinstein story. Slightly less dramatic than most people.
Are there plans for movie follow-ups for the other two books then?
There's no concrete plans, but this, we've certainly kind of talked loosely around it. I think we all really enjoyed making the movie, and the movie made the studio a lot of money. So let's just say I don't think anything is ruled out, but it would depend on Amelia's availability, and I think Amelia would want to do it with Thea, and obviously I would want to write it. So who knows? It's one of these kind of open-ended questions, but certainly none of us have ruled it out.
You write about some really tough issues, you know, dealing with end of life with dignity, lesbian and gay issues. You know, some of your characters are dealing with illnesses, facing their own end of life. Your characters are dealing with having to be discreet and honest to kind of keep their jobs. What prompts you to tackle any one of these issues?
I just write what I see. You know, I think unless you lead a pretty closeted life, you are up against these issues in your own family and in your own doings pretty much every day. I mean, you know, in my own family, we've pretty much covered all those issues that you're talking about in the last 3 years. So I just think just because you're a commercial writer, or, you know, a lot of people describe it as chick lit or whatever, I just think you do a disservice if you don't tackle the issues that you see around you. Just because something might make you laugh doesn't mean it might not also make you think. So I just tried to reflect the world as I see it.
Now, I know you probably spent some time in New York with publishers, but was that enough time to get a feeling for the city? Because your third book takes place in New York City. Did you have a more extended research trip?
Yeah. And you know, I'm an ex-journalist, and I believe wholeheartedly in the importance of proper research when it comes to representing something on a page. And I really feel that, you know, I know a lot of writers just depend on Google now. They just, you know, they do Google Street View and all that kind of stuff. But for me, you have to be there. You have to kind of walk the sidewalk, smell the smells, eat the food, listen to the way people speak to each other. All that kind of color is absolutely vital in terms of bringing something to life. And when I was deciding to write about not just New York, but this very specific area of New York, I was very conscious that, you know, for example, I grew up in London for 30 years. And if somebody writes about South London and they're a North Londoner, they're going to get stuff wrong because the two sides just don't meet. So I thought there must be the same kind of nuances in Manhattan. So I asked the experts, you know, I asked realtors who had dealt with property around Central Park. I have a friend of a friend who got me into one of the apartments overlooking Central Park so that I could literally get a perspective of how it looks you know, to be up there looking down on Manhattan, and also just to sort of look at the blood flow around the building, you know, how packages come in and out, how people move around, how much access the doorman has, how people eat and swim and go to the gym, and how, you know, small details like the fact that on Fifth Avenue there is literal carpet on the sidewalk between the openings to some of these buildings and the limos, so that people literally don't have to get their feet dirty, which I find kind of amazing and extraordinary. So, yeah, it was all those little details that I needed to soak up to make this compelling, because the thing that worried me more than anything was that I was going to produce this book that was essentially set in New York, and then to have New Yorkers go, but you've just got that completely wrong. There's nothing worse.
But then I really appreciated when you took Louisa up to do the library closing protests in Washington Heights, because I when I went to BEA a few years ago, I had a friend who lived in Washington Heights and I stayed there. And so I really was able to appreciate how you were able to note the difference between what Louisa had been surrounding herself with those first few weeks before she actually made the trip up to Washington Heights. How much time did you spend up there?
Well, I did the same thing. There is a very good public library in Washington Heights where I arranged to have access and speak to one of the librarians, and she took me around. And that was absolutely vital, because she showed me that, just as in the UK, in that part of the city, which is, you know, pretty challenged as far as opportunities and money and resources go, how the library was not just a place where people could reserve books. It was a place of safety. It was a place of learning. It was a place where people could learn computer skills and make job applications and sit in the warm or sit in the cool in the summer. It was a place where young people could come after school and even earn money on mentoring programs. And, you know, walking around that library, there was one woman who came up the stairs and, you know, I don't use the expression dirt poor lightly. This woman had actual holes in her clothes. She was lead stained. You know, she was probably the most impoverished person I've ever seen in the U.S. And she had a plastic bag full of books. And I thought, if that doesn't show you the importance of a library, I just don't know what would. And in the U.K., our libraries are being closed at a rate of knots, and I don't know how bad it is in the U.S., but I know that they're under some financial pressures. And I feel absolutely passionate that, you know, libraries are one of the few places we have left that is a community space in which people do not have to pay money, but have access to entertainment and to a way to educate themselves. And if we lose that resource, we lose something that we will never get back. And so, yeah, there's a tiny little political point in me including that, but I hope it just reminds people, it just gives them a gentle nudge to use their libraries and to appreciate them, because what's happening in the UK is it's being starved of resources, which means that then they can't buy in the books that people really want. So people then don't go to the library because they go, oh, well, if they only manage to get two copies of such and such, and there's like 100-strong waiting list, and then it becomes a vicious circle.
You know, that's actually one of the quotes that I wrote down in my questions where you, I think it was the doorman who said, you have to have your places for community. And, you know, I've heard of bookstores as the third place. I've heard of bars as the third place. But neither of those are a place where you can actually go for free and get
exactly
something back. But a library absolutely is. So
it really is.
How do books published, like your books, published in the UK, do they differ much from the US versions?
Not hugely, no. I mean, we always do a double edit where initially both my New York and my English editor go over the same manuscript and they talk about, you know, things where they perhaps agree I could do some more character development, or whether there's a plot line that they don't feel works, or, you know, some bits that need to be tightened. I'm a bit of an overwriter, so I usually need to cut some stuff. But then we do a finer edit once those basic changes are done, where we change the English words that Americans might not get the immediate references to, the cultural references that might not work in the States. And the changes are pretty minute. I think, you know, there's no major differences, but there are lots of tiny little differences, I guess, to do with language.
There is a part in the book where Louisa, during a conversation with Josh Ryan III, commented internally, I had forgotten that Americans don't really do irony.
Am I going to get in trouble?
No. Well, maybe I should find that again so I can see what my specific question was. Was she teasing him? And is that what you meant by the irony? I mean, talk to me a little bit about what she meant, because it wasn't you. Well, Louisa said it.
Yeah, but often you find the weird thing about being a writer now is often you get told off for things that your characters say. We're in a very strange time at the moment where, you know, you have to be very careful about what you're, I don't know, there's something a bit odd going on, but I'm often called out for things that my characters do, and I just have to respond. You know, they're characters. They don't always say the right thing or do the right thing, and that's kind of the point. They're on a learning curve. But anyway, with Louisa, I guess I was just thinking about the fact that, you know, perhaps irony is the wrong word, but sometimes someone will ask me, okay, I did it the other day in an interview. Someone was asking me how it was coming to do research in New York. And I said, well, that was obviously really tough. And I meant it kind of jokingly. It was like an English dry humor thing. I actually meant the opposite. I was saying I was really happy to do it. But I forgot that sometimes that's not interpreted in the same way in the States. It's that thing, you know, I can't say, for example, if I'm speaking to an audience, I've written this book, it's quite good, which is an English person's way of saying, I think this book is really fantastic, but I can't actually say that. And in America, you actually have to say, I've written this book, and I think it's fantastic, which doesn't necessarily come naturally to an English person. So I have to kind of switch on my American self when I'm here and be less awkward about promoting myself, but also just, you know, don't do dry, self-effacing humor, because it doesn't always work. People don't always hear it in the same way.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about your knowledge of fashion, because Louisa has extensive knowledge of vintage fashion. Is that something that you share with her, or do you have to research that?
Well, weirdly, it's something that she's given me. Sometimes your characters end up changing you, and I'm not actually very high fashion. I live in the countryside. My standard uniform is jeans, boots, shirt, jumper, as my husband will testify, much to his disappointment. But I have developed a love of vintage fashion. So there are a couple of websites that I used to use regularly to buy vintage fashion. There's a little store in London where I used to go and borrow things for events. And so I suppose because of that, I have become more interested in the process, but I'm just not a massive shopper. Do you know what I mean? I like to do a bit, but you could probably send me out 4 times a year and I would get everything that I needed for that year. I don't have a huge, I don't know, kind of desire to spend my Saturday buying stuff. I get a bit panicked about the amount of stuff that comes into my house anyway, you know, between 3 kids and a husband. It just, you know, I'm always fighting the waves of clutter. So I kind of like the vintage thing as well, because it's a bit green, you know, you're recycling stuff, you're using stuff that already has a history as well. I suppose the storyteller in me quite likes the fact that the dresses that I buy tend to have stories attached to them, even if I don't know them.
Well, we've talked about it a little bit, and I know I don't have you for much longer, but is there anything about the book that you'd like to talk about that I haven't asked? Or the series?
I guess with my slightly feminist head on, I would say one of the things about this book that perhaps differs from when I wrote the first book was that I'd become aware over the last 5-6 years of how many girls had a kind of quite intense relationship with Louisa, you know, how she really meant something to them, she spoke to them, and I find that when I do signings and people want to talk to me about how the struggles that she's been through have echoed things in their own lives. So when I decided to write book 3, I really, really thought very hard about what I wanted to put Louisa through, because it was really important to me to get the message right. I'm not saying that all fiction has to have a message, but it kind of does in a way, whether you want it to or not. And, you know, I have this theory that, well, life is very complicated at the moment, and for a lot of people it's quite bleak, and, you know, we're living through a slightly strange time in terms of reassessing our relationships with each other, whether they be political or gender relationships. And so it was important to me, even if I couldn't fix anything, to not be part of the problem, if that makes sense. And so I wanted to really end this book on a note that satisfied those girls, but also didn't necessarily tell them that the key to everything was getting married or having a baby or getting the right handbag or, you know, even just necessarily financial success, that it really had to do with things deeper within you, to understanding the things that made you happy, and then everything else kind of flows out from there. So that was a kind of key part of my thinking, and I really hope that when people read this that they feel perhaps uplifted and maybe a bit joyful, but that mostly they feel like she ended in the right space because she's such an important character to me as well as to a lot of other girls. And I felt this huge responsibility to get it right.
Do you want to talk about what's next? I mean, do you have anything?
Sure. I've been doing some research in Kentucky, of all places. My next book is very different. I can't say too much about it because I'm hugely superstitious until I've got 30,000 words done that I'm happy with. But it's loosely based on a true thing that happened after the Depression in Kentucky. So I've been out there finding out about Kentucky and being in the mountains, and it's been kind of life-changing, really. It was one of those trips that I was slightly dreading because the area that I was going to was a little bit rough around the edges. It has a huge opioid problem, and yet it turned out to be one of the most beautiful places. The people were amazing. You know, Kentuckians are storytellers, so that was amazing in itself. The landscape moved me in a way that I was unprepared for, and it's become my kind of imaginary happy place. You know, and you're having a bad day and you just sometimes need 5 minutes to sit down and think your way back to somewhere. Well, that was Kentucky for me, so I will be back there at some point to carry on with my research. But it's a very different kind of book I'm writing next, and I'm really excited about it.
That was JoJo Moyes, author of the book Still Me, which was published by Pamela Dorman Books, Viking. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover new episodes at KMUW.org or through iTunes, where you can subscribe so you won't miss an episode. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our editor is Luann Stevens. Our engineer is John Cyphers, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.